Your brother has wronged you. Should you forgive him? Or should you kick him out of your life? Your child disobeys you. Should you show them mercy? Should you discipline them? Should you let them suffer the consequences? What is the balance? Jesus told us to forgive our brother, however many times he sins against us. But he was assertive and didn't allow others to take advantage of him. The Proverbs clearly indicate that a parent should discipline their child to save them from destruction. Paul indicates that there is a time when the sinner must be cast out of the church. When do we play tit for tat? When do we forgive? When do we give someone up for judgment? When do we stop interacting entirely? I'm trying to show you something. It says it's trying to show you something. There we go. The prisoner's dilemma. This is sometimes presented as a one-time situation as follows. The warden has detained two people he believes were cooperating to commit a crime, and he wants to get one to rat out the other. The sentence for this crime is 3 years. The warden talks to each of the prisoners separately, and neither knows the other's answer until both have made an irrevocable decision. Defect, to rat out the other, or cooperate and remain silent. Come on. Yes, there we go. If the prisoners cooperate, if they both remain silent, the warden has sufficient evidence to convict them of a lesser crime, and each is sentenced to 1 year in prison. If one player cooperates, as in he remains silent, and the other defects, as in he rats out the other, the warden sentences the silent prisoner to 3 years and makes a deal to release the other. If both prisoners defect, they rat out each other, the warden has enough evidence to convict both, but reduces the sentence to 2 years each. So, if you were caught in this situation, what choice would you make? If you cooperate, you could be jailed for 1 year or three. But if you defect, you might go free or be stuck in jail for 2 years. Regardless of what the other person decides, your personal choice to defect pays off better. What does the strategy look like when you're faced with this situation repeatedly? Instead of using positive punishment, giving an undesired result as a consequence for undesired behavior, the game now uses positive reinforcement, giving a desired result as a consequence for desired behavior. The iterated prisoner's dilemma is also called the peace war game. It'll get there. If both cooperate, each player gets 3 points. If one cooperates and the other defects, the cooperator gets 0 points, but the defector gets 5. And if both players defect, each player gets 1 point. Again, it looks less risky to defect. If you cooperate, you might get 3 points, or you might get 0. If you defect, you might get 5 points, better than that maximum of 3, or you might get only 1, which is still better than 0. When you play this game repeatedly, it actually pays to cooperate sometimes. Look at that payout chart when it comes back up again. This is not a zero-sum game. If both players cooperate, that green square up at the top, the players get a total of 6 points. If one defects, they only get 5 between them. And if they both defect, then they get a total of 2. While the personal payoff for defecting once is better than cooperating, the combined payoff is better if they both cooperate. So why bring up this game? Why am I talking about game theory today? How many of you guys are really interested in the board games at the end of the day today? Essentially, the peace war game can be used as a very simple model for interpersonal interactions. Whether each person is trying to cooperate with the other or the two are competing with each other, this game gives us a way to numerically score that behavior. What is a winning condition? Do you win because you got more points for yourself? Are you aiming for the highest combined score? Or maybe the two align somehow. Robert Axelrod set up a tournament in which different strategies for this peace war game would compete. Strategies that assume or generally lean toward defecting are called nasty strategies. Strategies that assume or lean toward cooperating are called nice strategies. There are three predominant strategies and several derivatives of them, and they are always defect, grim trigger, and tit for tat. Always defect is pretty self-explanatory. This player always defects. Grim trigger starts by cooperating, but once the other player defects, this player never forgives and defects for the rest of the game. Go ahead and turn to Hebrews 10, and we'll start in verse 26. There it goes again. Hebrews 10, starting in verse 26. For if we deliberately continue to sin after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but only the terrifying prospect of judgment, of raging fire that will consume the enemies. Tit for tat. This strategy reciprocates. It starts by cooperating and only defects if the other player defected last time. It forgives quickly, forgetting whether the other player has defected in the past. Let's turn now to 1 Corinthians 13. I must be at like the range, the very range of this clickshare device. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we'll start in verse 4. Love is patient and kind, not jealous, not boastful, not proud, rude, or selfish, not easily angered, and it keeps no record of wrongs. The always defect strategy can pay off in the short term. After five rounds against the grim trigger strategy or the tit for tat strategy, always defect will come away with 9 points. And the others, only 4. Against itself, though, the always defect strategy only gets 5 points. The nice strategies, grim trigger and tit for tat, get 15 points against each other. Some of the other strategies submitted to the tournament would probe to see how one would respond or be a little more forgiving. Let's say we had a suspicious tit-for-tat strategy, where instead of assuming cooperate, it assumes defect. If you play 5 rounds against always defect or itself, the suspicious tit-for-tat would only get 5 points. Yes, there we are. Against tit for tat, 15 points. And you can see that it's alternating between red and green there. So that kind of illustrates a strained relationship. Against grim trigger, 9 points. Let's say we had a tit for two tat strategy. So it doesn't defect until the other person has defected twice in a row. This tit for two tats, playing for 5 rounds against always defects, only gets 3 points, where always defect gets 13. Against suspicious tit for tat, it gets 12 points. And against Grim Trigger, or Tit for Tat or itself, 15 points. Again, that's our maximum for 5 rounds. So, what if communication breaks down? One advantage this game has over real life is clear, reliable, unambiguous information. There are only 2 choices. Each player's decision is transmitted clearly and accurately. The other player sees defect when you intend to defect. The other player sees cooperate when you intend to cooperate. There are no accidents. There are no misinterpretations. But, of course, real life doesn't work that way. During the Cold War, there were several incidents that nearly led to nuclear war because of miscommunication. The perceived cost of nuclear war served as a significant deterrent. To better model real life, let's put some noise in the game. Now, the wrong signal will get sent out by one or the other player about 1 time out of 10. So about 1 time out of 10, there will be some miscommunication. How does that affect the game? We must expand the game to catch the effect. So let's go with 200 rounds. You ready for this? The minimum combined score is realized by 2 adversarial players. You're getting 2 points, 1 each, for 200 rounds. That's 200 points per person for a total of 400 points. And the highest combined score is realized by 2 cooperative players. You get 3 points per round for 200 rounds. That's 600 points each for a total of 1,200 points. So, a game of always defect, always playing itself, isn't that interesting. They're going to score near that minimum, and the difference will be due to the occasional misunderstanding. Somebody perceived to cooperate when they actually meant to defect. Come on. So here's a sample game of Grim Trigger against itself. It starts off on the right foot, but becomes adversarial after the first misunderstanding and stays that way for the rest of the game. When we get to the end of the game, it's coming. The score is pretty low. Because there was such an adversarial relationship for most of the game, you end up with 240, 250 points a person. Where, again, you're striving for that 600, right? It's a lot easier to understand when you've got the visuals. There we go. That's where we are. Thank you, Steve. Oh, thank you, Abby. All right, so you can see how they got into an adversarial relationship, and you're just seeing red. And there's a little bit of noise, there's a little bit of green in there, but mostly you're just seeing a lot of red up there. Because Grim Trigger never forgives. And when we get to the end of the game, you see the score there, 242 against 262. This is a sample game, but that's pretty representative. This is a sample strategy of Grim Trigger playing against Tit for Tat. Again, they started off on the right foot, but it got adversarial, and there's a lot of red there. And you'll see an exchange of green once in a while, but Grim Trigger, the one on top, never forgives. And so where the bottom one might give you a green like that one there, Grim Trigger doesn't reciprocate. It's a little better than before, but still a pretty low score. Against Tit for Two Tats, oh, I'm sorry, this is the suspicious Tit for Tat. It started off on the wrong foot. They were adversarial from the beginning. And it's just a whole lot of red. There's a little bit of an exchange of green in there, but mostly it's just red. And again, you're looking at a pretty low score with Grim Trigger. Against Tit for Two Tats, it does a little bit better, but once Tit for Two Tats accidentally defects, it's a whole lot of red. This is what happens if you hold a grudge, if you never forgive. It turns into an adversarial relationship. So let's look at how tit for tat does. Here you can see that it plays well against itself, starts off on the right foot, and there's the occasional miscommunication, but once you get a couple of miscommunications, it turns adversarial. And it might recover for a little bit, but another miscommunication, and you're in a strained relationship. Nonetheless, you can see that it's doing better than Grim Trigger did. There's a lot more green on that board. When we get to the end of the game here, that's a pretty decent score. 460 points, 470 points. Against suspicious tit for tat, well, they started off on the wrong foot. This is what happens when you assume that the other person has ill intent, right? You got a whole lot of red there. And then, you know, strained relationship, another miscommunication, there's a whole lot of red. A little bit of forgiveness, maybe, and then a whole lot more red. And so the suspicious tit for tat doesn't play well against tit for tat. 350 points. That's less than your average, if you want to say it. Against tit for two tats, well, that's pretty good. That's pretty promising. There's a lot of green there. And so you might think, oh, well, maybe tit for two tats is a better strategy than tit for tat, right? Well, the problem with tit for two tats is it's really easy to take advantage of tit for two tats because you know, oh, well, if I defect this turn, then if I cooperate next turn, everything will be okay with the other player. And then I can defect the turn after that and then cooperate and defect and cooperate. And so when you're seeing that kind of a strategy here, yeah, tit for two tats didn't do very well. They got taken advantage of. So we can see how the tit for tat and tit for two tat strategies consistently outperform these other strategies. While tit-for-tat strategy might work well in a world with perfect communication and still perform okay when there's miscommunication, we saw how a couple of miscommunications can lead to an adversarial relationship. When communication is imperfect, the best strategy to improve the outcome is forgiveness. Maybe the other person meant to cooperate, and I misunderstood. How would we simulate forgiveness in the game? So let's sway the strategy a little bit toward cooperation. About one time out of 10 when the player would defect, they'll cooperate instead. So here's a sample game with two forgiving tit-for-tat players. You can see that there's the occasional miscommunication, and it sometimes leads to a strained relationship, pictured here with the alternating red and green. However, one will forgive the other, and they'll cooperate again. Rarely does it become adversarial, and when it does, a couple doses of forgiveness will result in a cooperative game again. Look at that final score. That's almost perfect, and there's noise and miscommunication in the game. How would we classify Jesus' interactions with those around him? Clearly, he cooperated with those who were willing to cooperate with him. But would we classify his interactions with the Sadducees and the Pharisees as cooperation? Most of them were clearly adversarial toward him. And while he wasn't outright hostile toward them, he wasn't as cooperative with them as he was with others. Yet, his willingness to forgive brought high-ranking religious leaders such as Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, Paul, to his side. We've all heard the Lord's Prayer as laid out in Matthew 6. Go ahead and turn to Matthew 6 and Luke 11. What is the only portion of that which requires no action? What is the only part of that which requires action on your part? So this is Matthew 6, and we'll look at verse 14. For if you forgive us our debts, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. The portion of that which requires action on our part is to forgive others. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And what is it that he addresses immediately after he provides this model prayer? That's what's in verse 14. For if you forgive others their offenses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their offenses, your heavenly Father will not forgive yours. So immediately after giving this model prayer, he cuts right to the part of that prayer that you need to take action on. Forgiveness and reconciliation are the keys to recovering a broken relationship. Let's turn back a little bit to Matthew 5 and verse 25. Matthew 5, verse 25. If someone sues you, come to terms with him quickly while you and he are on the way to court, or he may hand you to the judge and the judge to the officer of the court, and you may be thrown in jail. I quoted Hebrews 10 earlier and associated it with the grim trigger strategy. The grim trigger strategy seems an adequate approximation of how that scripture was taught from the pulpit when I was growing up in the church. But does that really reflect God's strategy? Let's bring in some context. Let's turn back to Hebrews 10. And we'll start in verse 19. Hebrews 10, starting in verse 19. So, brothers, we have confidence to use the way into the holiest place opened by the blood of Jesus. He inaugurated it for us as a new and living way through the veil by means of his flesh. We also have a great priest over God's household. Therefore, let us approach the holiest place with a sincere heart in the full assurance that comes from trusting, with our hearts sprinkled clean from a bad conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us continue holding fast to the hope we acknowledge without wavering, for the one who made the promise is trustworthy. And let us keep paying attention to one another in order to spur each other on to love and good deeds, not neglecting our own congregational meetings, as some have made a practice of doing, but rather encouraging each other. And let us do this all the more as you see the day approaching. For if we deliberately continue to sin after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but only the terrifying prospect of judgment, of raging fire that will consume the enemies. Someone who disregards the law of Moses is put to death without mercy on the word of two or three witnesses. Think how much worse will be the punishment deserved by someone who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, who is treated as something common, the blood of the covenant which made him holy, and who has insulted the Spirit, giver of God's grace. For the one we know is the one who said, "Vengeance is my responsibility, I will repay." And then said, "The Lord will judge his people. It is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But remember the earlier days when, after you had received the light, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings. Sometimes you were publicly disgraced and persecuted, while at other times you stood loyally by those who were treated this way. For you shared the sufferings of those who had been put in prison. Also, when your possessions were seized, you accepted it gladly, since you knew that what you possessed was better and would last forever. So, don't throw away that courage of yours, which carries with it such a great reward. For you need to hold out, so that by having done what God wills, you may receive what he has promised. For there is so little time. The one coming will indeed come. He will not delay. But the person who is righteous will live his life by trusting, and if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. However, we are not the kind to shrink back and are destroyed. On the contrary, we keep trusting and thus preserve our lives." Now that we have the context, how does that affect the interpretation? We've repented. And God has accepted Jesus' sacrifice and forgiven us. We should seek each other out. we should cooperate with and encourage each other. These are the end days. Live today like the world will end tomorrow. If you continue living in sin, you may not have time to repent tomorrow. Don't seek vengeance against your brother. God promises mercy to those who seek him and judgment for those who turn away. Worry about your own walk and let God be the judge of your brother. And be forgiving. Remember, you have stumbled too. If God were playing the game as a grim trigger, what is the point in repenting? Surely, David committed two great sins that are recorded in the Bible, yet Jesus and the prophets proclaim that he will be resurrected and become king of Israel again. The parable of the prodigal son also illustrates that God will welcome you back as a son if you return to him, as with the parable of the talents. If you are not responsible with much in this life, you will not be given much responsibility in the next. We can see that the best strategies for a high combined score are also the best strategies for a high personal score. While an adversarial strategy to take advantage of the other's willingness to cooperate may pay off in the short term, it clearly doesn't work in the long term. Similarly, God asks us to sacrifice a pursuit of short-term gains so that we can realize a greater long-term gain as part of a community. Eye for an eye. So this tit-for-tat strategy that I've been talking about, doesn't it sound a bit like an eye for an eye? Doesn't the saying go, an eye for an eye will make the whole world blind? But is that what God really meant? Let's turn to Exodus. Exodus chapter 21. And we'll start in verse 23. Exodus 21, verse 23. But if any harm follows, then you are to give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and bruise for bruise. When we hear eye for an eye today, it tends to be in the context of people engaging in vigilante justice. Recently, we've heard this applied to the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You killed my child, so I'll kill your child. Is that what God intended? Not at all. Again, let's look at the context. Let's look at verse 1. Look at verse 1. This is how the chapter starts. These are the rulings you are to present to the children of Israel. And everything that follows are prescriptions for God's justice. This prescription, an eye for an eye, is just one of those prescriptions. God does not prescribe vigilante justice. God may sanction the execution of justice by an individual, as with the next of kin pursuing a murderer, but God does not allow individuals to take justice into their own hands. An eye for an eye is the result of a judgment in the court of law. The individual harmed brings his case and witnesses before a court and makes his accusation. It is only after the court judges in his favor that said justice will be levied. Even then, it would not necessarily result in the destruction of the culprit's eye. The Talmud indicates that in practice, such injury would be ransomed. The culprit would pay the value of the eye, the tooth, the foot, or whatever irreparable harm was caused. An eye for an eye works because the individual wronged does not exact vengeance. The individual brings it to the state, and after careful consideration, the state exacts retribution. God's law takes violence out of the hands of the individual and gives it to the state. People are not allowed to seek vengeance individually. You must bring it to the state, and the state will render judgment. And the state here is simply a picture of what God would be. God sitting as the judge and the executioner. Let's look at how Jesus said we should resolve our disputes. I'm sure we've heard this plenty of times. Let's go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18, and starting in verse 15. Matthew 18, starting in verse 15. Moreover, if your brother commits a sin against you, go and show him his fault, but privately, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won back your brother. If he doesn't listen, take one or two others with you so that every accusation can be supported by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to hear them, tell the congregation. And if he refuses to listen even to the congregation, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Yes, I tell you that whatever you prohibit on earth will be prohibited in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven. To repeat, I tell you that if two of you here on earth agree about anything people ask, it will be for them from my Father in heaven. For wherever two or three are assembled in my name, I am there with them. The first step in conflict resolution is to talk with your brother in private. Even then, if your brother isn't ready to resolve the conflict, you still interact with him personally. But each of you would bring witnesses, and hopefully the witnesses will help arbitrate. Finally, if a small group like this can't resolve the issue, you bring the conflict before the congregation, probably the elders, as the Jews would historically have brought a conflict before a court found from the elders of the city. Let's turn to Luke 12. Luke 12, starting in verse 13. Luke 12, verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Rabbi, tell my brother to share with me the property we inherited." But Jesus answered, "My friend, who appointed me judge and arbitrator over you?" Wouldn't Jesus be the ideal arbitrator in this case? Yet he implies that this case should go through the system first. I'm not your judge and your arbitrator. Seek them out first. This would be like somebody taking a petty dispute straight to Moses. And that's how they did it at first, right? They'd take it straight to Moses. And his father-in-law says, "You're wearing yourself out." Set up a system so that you can spread out the burden. So what's next? If you and your brother can't find a resolution to the conflict, and the conflict is going to poison the fellowship, someone needs to leave. This is another way in which the peace war game differs from real life. The game requires you to continue interacting with the other player until the game ends. How many of us would want to play 200 rounds against an adversarial opponent? How many of us would want to play 200 rounds against someone who keeps an account of past wrongs and never forgives? Wouldn't you rather quit playing the game after repeated injury? Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and we're starting in verse 9. 1 Corinthians 5, 9. "In my earlier letter, I wrote you not to associate with people who engage in sexual immorality. I didn't mean the sexually immoral people outside your community, or the greedy, or the thieves, or the idol worshippers, for then you would have to leave the world altogether. No, what I wrote you was not to associate with anyone who is supposedly a brother, but who also engages in sexual immorality, is greedy, worships idols, is abusive, gets drunk, or steals. With such a person, you shouldn't even eat. For what business is it of mine to judge outsiders? Isn't it those who are part of the community that you should be judging? God will judge those who are outside. Just expel the evildoer from among yourselves. How dare one of you with a complaint against another go to court before pagan judges and not before God's people? Don't you know that God's people are going to judge the universe? If you are going to judge the universe, are you incompetent to judge over minor matters? Don't you know that we will judge angels, not to mention affairs of everyday life? So if you require judgments about matters of everyday life, why do you put them in front of men who have no standing in the church? I say, shame on you. Can it be that there isn't one person among you wise enough to be able to settle a dispute between brothers? Instead, a brother brings a lawsuit against another brother, and that before unbelievers. God expects us to exercise judgment. We must judge disputes among ourselves. We must judge those who are poisoning our fellowship and purge them. It pays in the long term to cooperate. We sacrifice short-term individual gain to contribute more to the community, to build the community, and help the community thrive. Relationships work best when we assume others have good intentions and we don't hold grudges. Communication is imperfect. Sometimes we have the best of intentions, but others misinterpret our words or misunderstand our actions. Sometimes we intend to cooperate and we end up being treated as defectors. Forgiveness is essential. There are natural consequences for mistakes and misunderstandings, and we will often pay those consequences. That payment should be a learning experience. However, we must exercise love. We must be quick to forgive, not keeping a record of wrongdoing. That only hurts the relationships we have with others. But when someone causes irreparable harm or starts to poison the fellowship, it is not our place to punish that person individually. We should seek to settle things quickly and in private. If things get out of hand, it's up to the community to hear such cases and, if appropriate, require recompense or purge the poison. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy 29, verse 18. Deuteronomy 29:18. So, let there not be among you a man, woman, family, or tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Let there not be among you a root bearing such bitter poison and wormwood. Let's close with James 3. James 3, verse 17. But the wisdom from above is first of all pure, then peaceful, kind, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And peacemakers who sow seed in peace raise a harvest of righteousness.